Hi everyone, and welcome back to Mohawk Podcast. Today will be a very special presentation as we will be discussing the new DLC for Old World, Pharaohs of the Nile. My name is Dale and I am your host for this podcast. Joining me is Solver.
Hello, good to be here. I'm Solver with Mohawk, and my previous work on Old World includes the Rise of Carthage and Heroes of the Aegean campaigns.
And we also have Josh.
Hello, yeah, thanks for having us. Yeah, I'm a writer and designer on Old World, worked on the Sacred and Profane previously.
Fantastic, it's good to all be here. So we're here today to talk about the new DLC that is coming from Mohawk for the game Old World. And the DLC is called Pharaohs of the Nile. Now this is a very interesting DLC because it's not just one part, it's going to have two parts to it, similar to Heroes of the Aegean. So it's going to have a campaign that focuses on Egypt. And secondly, we're adding a new faction, the Kush. So this DLC will be focusing on the Nile region, both Egypt and the Kush. There is a campaign of six scenarios, which are going to be on Egypt. And it is going to culminate in facing the ultimate enemy of Egypt, the Kush.
So, in Pharaohs of the Nile, we have a new campaign arriving, which will be the third historical campaign for Old World. And this time it's an Egyptian campaign focusing on the New Kingdom period of Egypt. So, Dale, if we start with it at the highest level, why are we doing Egypt this time? What was your inspiration behind that and your idea for picking Egypt specifically as the third campaign?
I think specifically, it just comes down to one easy thing for me. I actually want to go see the pyramids one day and have a look at all the monuments from the ancient era of Egypt. Because Egypt is one of the longest running ancient empires in the world. It's got a fantastic history of millennia. And scores and scores of famous people who led Egypt, who took it to greatness and made such an impact on the future world.
So, if you answer without thinking, who's your favorite pharaoh?
Favorite pharaoh? I think it would have to be Pharaoh Akhenaten. Pharaoh Akhenaten was in the 18th dynasty, and he is famous for a religious reformation. And he converted Egypt into a monotheistic religion.
And he's one of the pharaohs showing up at least briefly in the DLC, right?
Yes, he'll be appearing within the DLC.
As you said, there are six scenarios, which would then be the same length as the previous Heroes of the Aegean campaign, right? So if you would take us through the overall view of what each scenario is about, and then we can talk a little bit more about each of them.
Pharaohs of the Nile is a six scenario campaign. It focuses on the New Kingdom period, which is from approximately 1500 BCE to 1000 BCE, and it covers the 18th, 19th, and 20th dynasty of Egypt. We start off with scenario one, which is called unification. And essentially what the player needs to do is they start out as Waset and they need to go and conquer and unite all of Egypt. Because in the north, they've got the Hyksos, who are an Asiatic peoples who took over the Nile Delta. And so as the player pushes the Hyksos out, they will then move to the south and focus on the Kerma. Now the Kerma is a culture and a nation who was south of Egypt. Now during the collapse, about 300 years earlier, Kermit actually pushed north and took over some of Egypt's Middle Kingdom lands. And this is where the player finds himself at the start of Scenario 1. So essentially they need to recreate Egypt.
I guess this will also be an opportunity to learn a little bit more about the constituent parts and kingdoms and such of Egypt, right? Because to many people, Egypt is just Egypt, a large united empire, but here we will see that historically it was not quite so, right?
Exactly. So throughout this campaign, the player will actually learn a lot about how Egypt came to become so powerful, because the player themselves will actually be taking the same steps that the pharaohs in that time took to create the Egyptian empire and to become essentially the most powerful empire in the whole of the Mediterranean.
Who was this first pharaoh who does the unification that you play as?
So the player starts off as Ahmose the First. Technically, when you first begin the campaign, you're not actually pharaoh because you don't actually control all of Egypt. So the goal is to found the 18th dynasty, and therefore you will become Pharaoh Ahmose the First.
Well, that's a very good and appropriate beginning for a campaign to see how the empire arose. And as you said, then that concludes scenario one. Egypt is united. You are a pharaoh. Well, where do we go next? What's in scenario two then?
So we jump ahead a bit in time, about 100 years, to Pharaoh Hatshepsut. Pharaoh Hatshepsut already features within Old World, but in Scenario 2, you actually focus on her story. Hatshepsut is famous for building a lot of the New Kingdom's monuments, including lots of the Temple of Karnak, plus also temples and obelisks, and also other shrines and monuments around Egypt. So in Scenario 2, it's more of a builder focus. So you get to build up the power of Egypt. You need to unite your people within the religion. You need to extend trade out to outside the map and find new trade partners to increase your prosperity. You need to finish off the war with the Hyksos, take over parts of the Middle East. Plus also, you need to create your own everlasting legacy. Now, that is a two-step phase in that you create your mortuary temple. And then after that, you need to create obelisks with your story across the land so that everyone remembers who you are.
Since I have, of course, played the campaign, I think I have to say for myself, Scenario 2 is probably my favorite one in the campaign, because of how many things you have to manage at the same time. There is there is the monumental building, there is some trade, there is some military, and you really see it develop quite rapidly. You don't start maybe with such an epic feeling, and by the end of it you've really built up in this scenario, and then you can see, oh yeah, this looks, well, much more like an empire in its golden age. So that's a really fun scenario.
Exactly. I built it so that it was going to be lots of fun for builders. Like you say, you take Egypt from being a minor power and you take it up into a great power within the Eastern Mediterranean.
And then after this, after the golden period, we arrive in scenario three at, I believe, a more difficult period in Egyptian history, a serious period of internal conflict. Is that right?
Yes, it is. So in scenario three, we jump ahead a bit to what's known as the Amarna period. Now, the player in the scenario is Pharaoh Akhenaten. Now, Akhenaten, as I mentioned earlier, is my favorite pharaoh because he he instituted religious reform. So there is a story to leading up to Akhenaten, which players will learn about as they play the as they enter the scenario. But essentially, his father worshipped a god called the Aten. Now, the Aten was an aspect of Ra, the sun god. Akhenaten came to love the Aten so much that he believed that the whole of the universe was created by the Aten, and that all the other Egyptian gods were just different aspects of the Aten. So what he did was he decided to institute monotheism, and he said, all of Egypt is now going to worship the Aten. I'm going to rip up all the other temples, I'm going to outlaw them, and everyone must worship the Aten. Well, as you can imagine, the cult of Amun, which was the largest cult in Egypt at the time, wasn't too happy about that, and neither were the people of Egypt. So scenario three takes you through the process of converting Egypt to a monotheistic religion and lets you face some of the troubles that Pharaoh Akhenaten actually faced in that time.
Can you tell us a little bit about how that works? Mechanically, so what is it you have to do in gameplay terms as part of this religious conflict?
Yeah, definitely. So scenario three is absolutely unique in Old World. There's no other scenario that exists like it. So in scenario three, the player themselves, there's no other nation in the world. You are by yourself. All you have access to is the borders and the land of Egypt. And what happens is, during the process of the scenario, there is a religious split. And as the player, you need to force your religion onto the other religion. And the way you do that is using some unique units. So in scenario three, it's not about the military. It's not about your civilians. It's about religious units. There is a special tech tree which has been replaced completely with abilities that you can give to your religious units. For example, like smite and purge religion and pillage shrines. And as you go through the scenario, your religious units will become more powerful, and you'll be facing off against the cult of Amun, who is also at the same time creating religious units and trying to push you out of your cities. And essentially, it's a civil war based on religion.
Well, that's a very interesting and really unique concept for Old World, because the game does not, other than that, have any outright religious conflict. Usually you spread your religions, maybe. Well, there are some situations where you can purge it, but this full-scale religious civil war, as you put it, that's something completely unique for the third scenario, which I think will also feature guest appearances by some other known characters like Pharaoh Akhenaten. He also had a fairly famous son, and some other people who may be making an appearance.
And a terribly famous wife.
Yeah, she's quite famous.
So scenario three is my favorite scenario out of the whole campaign, because it is so different to anything else within Old World.
One of the remarkable things about this campaign is that several scenarios are really, really unique. So after the religious one with the Amarna reforms, so is the next one. The fourth scenario is, I believe, also something completely unlike what we have in the game, right?
Yes, so with scenario four, we actually visit a period of time which is known for having one of the most famous pharaohs in all of Egypt's history. This is the time of Pharaoh Ramses II, quite often called the Great. He's also, within Egypt, known as the ancestor pharaoh. So the fourth scenario is called the Battle of Kadesh. So during Pharaoh Ramses II's reign, the Hittites were pushing south into the Middle East. And Pharaoh Ramses II sent an expedition north to face the Hittites. And they met at a city called Kadesh. Now, Kadesh itself had massive city walls and wasn't actually able to be taken by either side. So the battle itself was conducted on the plains surrounding the city. Now, scenario 4 takes a very focused, close-up tactical view of this battlefield. And as the player, as Pharaoh Ramses II, you will face the Hittites in the same situation as Pharaoh Ramses II actually faced. I did a lot of research of the actual war plans of the battle and how the actual battle was conducted. And the scenario does actually flow very closely here historically. It's quite a interesting beginning and it's a lot of fun.
Right, we don't want to spoil the fun, but one thing about the battle that's worth noting here is that the scenario also conveys the scale of the battle. So the Battle of Kadesh was not just a well-known clash between the Egyptians and Hittites, but it was also, I believe, one of the largest battles at the time, or one of the largest chariot battles known. And here in the scenario, there is a very real feeling of scale, because you're not fighting 5 or 7 units. It's full-sized armies clashing, and it's quite impressive.
Exactly, yes. So each side fielded at least 50,000 people, and a lot of them were actually based in the chariot, on chariots, both sides. And as you said, what I've done is I've focused so tightly onto it that each unit represents just a few men. So there are lots of units, and you're going to... It's got a massive scale and a massive feel to it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun for anyone who loves a hard tactical battle.
Although, to put people's worries at ease, it's not actually 50,000 units in the scenario, so that might be a little bit hard to play. We don't quite have that many.
Not that I didn't try.
No, you would have loved that. And as another remarkable feature of this scenario is that you can also play it as in multiplayer, where one player is Egypt and the other player is the Hittites. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So there is a special mode for it to be played as multiplayer. It is a little bit different to how single player plays, because obviously the balance has to be a little bit different for multiplayer, but it's also a lot of fun. And I can tell you that if you come across Fluffy Bunny playing as the Hittites, surrender immediately. Those heavy chariots of his just smash you.
Well, I think many of our experienced players know already the more general form of this advice. Just if you come across Fluffy Bunny, just surrender, because it's not going to get much better than that.
Exactly.
So, sometime after the Battle of Kadesh, historically, these empires, they signed a peace treaty, and that means that in Scenario 5, we don't see any continuation of the Hittite conflict. We go to something else once again, yes?
That is correct. So Scenario 5 is called the Hearts of Kemet. Now, this is another unique scenario within Old World, because it takes a completely different stance on how you win. Like in other scenarios, you win by either destroying your enemies or being so powerful or just completely overloading the map with your blob. The bigger blob wins. That's usually how a game of Old World works. But in the Hearts of Kemet, it's different. The goal is not to win, but it is actually to maintain balance. Now, there are two competing forces. Pharaoh Meneptah, who is Pharaoh Ramses II's son, one of his sons. He was the pharaoh at the time. And after Pharaoh Ramses II, the priests of Amun had gained a massive amount of power. and they were exerting a lot of influence on the people of Egypt. And what that was doing was reducing the power of Pharaoh. And Pharaoh Meneptah tried everything he possibly could to try and rebalance the country. In ancient Egypt, they had a concept called Maat, M-A-apostrophe-A-T. Now, Maat is all about balance. So like Christianity, where sins negate your opportunity to get into heaven, it doesn't work. Maat doesn't work like that. It allows you the opportunity to pay for any sins that you do. So once again, it's all about balance. So if you do something bad, it gives you the opportunity to pay that back.
It's like a credit. It's a credit account for sins.
Exactly. So if you take one out, you put one back in. If you put one in, it gives you the opportunity to take one out later. Scenario 5 focuses on this Ma'at balance, and you need to keep your empire in balance against the cult of Amun. So the cult of Amun will actually be doing their own actions within your empire. And as Pharaoh, you get to make decisions based on their actions, which will swing a Ma'at meter either towards the Pharaoh or towards the high priests. The goal of the scenario is to keep that meter in the middle, in balance.
So if you don't keep it in the middle, what does that represent? Is that some kind of collapse of civilization or a spiritual collapse, or what is it?
So ancient Egypt believed that all the gods and all the people had to maintain Ma'at, and the pharaoh was responsible as the conduit between the universe and the gods and the people to maintain Ma'at. And if Ma'at was not maintained, then the entire universe would devolve into chaos and just fold into itself and disappear. And that's the whole basis of their polytheistic religion.
Right, so that's a little bit higher stakes than usual. You're just about preventing the collapse of the whole universe, not just defeating some army.
Exactly, but if you lose scenario 5, you're not just going to collapse our universe, you're just going to lose.
Well, hopefully.
Well, I don't know. We haven't got it out there yet. Maybe if lots and lots of people lose scenario 5, maybe the universe will fold into itself and disappear.
Just one way to find out.
Buy the DLC and lose scenario 5, everyone.
So assuming the universe does survive, we do then have one more scenario left, which is the conclusion of the campaign.
Yeah, so now we enter the final scenario, scenario 6, which is titled The Sea People. Now, scenario 6 takes the player through what historians have called the Bronze Age collapse. Now, during the Bronze Age collapse, there were a string of disasters and calamities which led to a mass migration of people from Central Europe towards the Middle East. So the Middle East and Egypt was known as the food bowl of Europe at that time. So during the mass migration eastwards from Central Europe, a number of historic civilizations collapsed under the weight of the migration coming through. That included the Mycenaeans, the Hatti, the Assyrian and Egyptian empires. Plus, it also resulted in the destruction of some of the greatest cities in history, including Mycenae, Hattusa, and Ugarit. Historically, Egypt did survive the Sea People's invasion. However, the economic cost in resources and manpower, Egypt was unable to recover from that loss. And within 100 years, it actually collapsed as well. So scenario 6 takes the player through the Sea People's invasion. It has been designed as a tower defense game, where literally your goal is just to survive against wave after wave of raiders. And each wave will get stronger.
So there is no way to win the scenario, right? As in a classic tower defense, you hold out for as long as you can.
Yes, it's essentially hold out as long as you can. Now, there are milestones within the scenario to mark, you know, minor victory and major victory, but you can actually continue after the major victory and compete against people such as Siren Johnson and Fluffy Bunny and ourselves to see if you can beat their number of waves. So there's a leaderboard.
Who's at the top of the leaderboard, remind me?
I think it was it Siren or Fluffy Bunny?
Probably Fluffy, it's always Fluffy.
Yes, probably.
Which leaderboard that you made up, by the way, but...
Yes, I know. So scenario six is literally, how long can you survive? And if you do reach a victory milestone, then that will actually mark the completion of the campaign, even though you can continue playing on in scenario six.
Well, thank you for the detailed overview of the scenarios. And just to finish up on the campaign, I believe there are some broader new features also for the campaign as a whole, or some things that are common to all of the scenarios, some new mechanics.
Yes, I've tried to introduce a number of new features just to keep Old World a bit fresh with this new campaign. So the calendar that's used, I've used the traditional ancient Egyptian calendar. So it's a three-season calendar based around the harvest, like most of the ancient calendars were. And it also ties into the second feature as well, which is the Nile flood. So during ancient Egyptian times, the Nile would flood every year. And it was actually quite predictable, and it was regular in its occurrence. The only thing that was random was how heavy the flood would be, and that depended on the monsoon in Central Africa. So the monsoon would hit Central Africa, and all the waters from the monsoon would flood down the Nile and reach the Nile Delta and flood the plains there. And that was actually what enabled civilization to exist around the Nile. So the calendar is based on the Nile flood. So you have the first season, which is inundation, which is when the flood waters rise and inundate all the lands of the delta. And then the second season is planting and growing, which is when the farms were planted and crops were grown. And the third season is the harvest and celebration. So the farmers would go off and harvest their crops. And then at the end of the harvest, they would have a massive celebration, the end of the year. Now, the Egyptian calendar was unique because at the end of the year, they knew that the year had 365 days. But based on their calendar, they only covered 360 days. So the last 5 days were actually a special celebration. No one worked, not even officials. There were no records kept. And basically, anything that happened in those 5 days essentially didn't exist. And it was something completely unique about those 5 days within Egypt. It literally just 5 days of complete celebration.
Well, so celebration is, I think, probably the friendliest word we could use for that period. I can also think of a few other names.
Exactly. So they called them holy days. And when the Romans conquered Egypt after the 30th dynasty, they actually took this concept of holy days back to Rome, and it spread across the Roman world and eventually all of the Western world as holy days. And that's where the word comes from.
So we're saying we still have to thank Egyptians now for getting 2 days off a week.
Yes. The next feature I wanted to talk about would be the Temple of Karnak. So the Temple of Karnak is the largest temple complex in ancient Egypt. A lot of it exists today as ruins, and you can actually go there and visit them now. But the Temple of Karnak was built into its grandeur during the New Kingdom period. So during the second scenario, which is Pharaoh Hatshepsut, one of your goals is to build the Temple of Karnak. Now, as a wonder, it is a brand new, unique wonder for Old World, and it actually covers 7 tiles. So you start with a center tile, and you need to build the 6 surrounding tiles of the Temple of Karnak. And it can only be built on a specific location near Waset, where it is historically. And believe me, it will take a lot of stone, so build those quarries.
It does take quite a lot of stone and a fair amount of time to build it, but to everyone who builds it, it's definitely worth zooming in on. So Mark Cheyenne, our 3D artist, did a fantastic job with the Temple of Karnak. As such a large 7-tile wonder, it's a different feeling of scale to, anything else that exists in the game, and it's really detailed and large scale intricate. It's I think it's the best looking thing we've had in the game so far.
Yes, Mark did a phenomenal job with the Temple of Karnak. And one thing with the temple is that it actually exists all the way through the campaign after you build it.
So you've put in quite a lot of research for the Egyptian campaign. You've been dressing up as a pharaoh, learning Egyptian and all that. So you also put in some very nice historical flavor features into the campaign. Can you elaborate on those?
Yes, so I've basically had 12 months to research all about ancient Egypt. So what I've done is I've put a lot of that historical context into the game in a number of ways, actually. So in the encyclopedia, there's a whole new category which contains tons and tons of lore and historical references and stories all from ancient Egypt. So you can look up who the gods were and what their roles were. You can look up lots about mythology. You can look up about historical monuments, about ancient cities and how they got their names and grew. You can even, you know, drill down into the different pharaohs and find out their actual histories as well. So please check out the encyclopedia and just go for, well, basically fall down a rabbit hole and just read all about ancient Egypt's history. And along with that, I've also taken the time to use all of ancient Egypt's historical names and what they called things. So when you play the campaign, you're not actually Egypt, you're Kemet, which is the name that they gave themselves. So instead of Egypt, you're Kemet. And instead of the word pharaoh, which means great house, I've used their traditional name for, or their title for the pharaoh, which is Nesubidi. And along with that, I've also added all the hieroglyphics for the throne name of each pharaoh. So not only will you have their historical name, you will also have their hieroglyphic name as well as their Latinized alphabetic name.
Yeah, so we should make it clear to those listeners who are not fluent in reading Egyptian hieroglyphics, which might be a minority of our listeners, but nonetheless, that you don't have to be able to read ancient Egyptian to play the campaign, even though there is a wealth of historical information, and I believe even you can see the names of major geographic features, like the Nile River itself, in hieroglyphics as well, if you pick an option. Was that right?
Yes, there's an option within each scenario that you can play with hieroglyphic name, the historical Latin version of their name, as well as the just normal English name. It's interesting that you mentioned the Nile, because they didn't actually call that river the Nile. That's a modern construct. They actually called it Iteru, which means the river, because they had one river through their whole country. So they just said, oh, we live near the river, Iteru. So the name on the map is actually Iteru.
That's a very interesting historical context there, and just one of the many things you can learn while playing the campaign. Really, you can spend quite a bit of time with the DLC without actually playing it, just reading all the historical information included.
Exactly. I think there's probably more information in the encyclopedia for this DLC than there is for everything else in Old World.
And that also shows one of the coolest things about being game developer nerds. So we get to do nerdy stuff that we like, such as writing up tons of that historical information, or I did the technical support for being able to show Egyptian hieroglyphics in game, which is not a technical task I had ever thought I would be doing. Somewhere implementing hieroglyphic support, but here we are, and it's been a lot of fun.
And please, if you do play in hieroglyphics, let me know on our Discord. I'd love to know if there's anyone playing in hieroglyphic mode.
Yeah, let Dale know. You will be his favorite person straight away.
It's certainly a different way to play, I'll tell you that.
And finally, for the campaign, so Egypt is the focus, but there's also a couple other nations and peoples who are sort of in the background and whose story continues throughout the campaign.
Yes. So in Scenario 5, as you push south, you come across a forming tribe called Kush. In Scenario 5, they're just still a tribe, but they are going to give you a bit of a headache in the scenario. And then once we get to Scenario 6, they've actually formed a full nation, the Kush. And they can either be a hindrance or a help in Scenario 6 against the Sea Peoples.
And these Kush, they are, of course, the same Kush that is then included as a separate playable nation in our Pharaohs of the Nile DLC. And Kush is a full nation, which is, what will that be? That will be our ninth nation,
yes,
I believe.
Yes, our ninth.
Yeah, it's our ninth nation for those who have Heroes of the Aegean with the Hittites, or it will be the eighth nation if you do not have any DLCs prior to that. And for the Kush, we have Josh, who designed the nation, and would you like to give us a little bit of introduction on who they are historically and who they are in the game, Josh?
Yeah, absolutely. So Kush are the, as the kind of name of the DLC suggests, they're the other pharaohs of the Nile. So they had this kingdom of Kush, which lies just south of Egypt, in kind of the area that's like modern day South Egypt and northern Sudan. And they had a really interesting like back and forth with Egypt across many, many years. So there was this back and forth both in terms of like invasions. They both kind of invaded each other and controlled each other at different times. And also culturally, there was this kind of like transfer back and forth of ideas. That's kind of, yeah, like why I thought there'd be a great nation to include in this. And like, sadly, they've been overlooked a lot in history. Yeah, so sadly, a lot of the interesting like Kush-like sites were looted before they had a chance to really be explored and studied. So yeah, like things like that mean that they've just not had as much focus as Egypt. So we also wanted to put them in for that reason, and kind of have them as this full, unique culture. So in terms of gameplay, they have quite a unique focus around pagan religion. Kush had various capitals across the years. They started as the Kerma culture that was brought up, that's going to be in Scenario 1 and 2. And then later on, they had a capital at Napata, which was this religious centre, and this is when the cult of Amun, which is thought that they knew Amun as Amani, really took off. And the cult of Amun was a huge power within Kush, to the extent where it's thought that the priests of Amun could actually command the king to commit suicide and go to war. You know, there was this proper, like, shadow government, almost, with incredible power. So we kind of wanted to represent that a bit. So in terms of actually, like, gameplay, they get their shrines get a plus 50% base output, which they've got some really useful shrines which give, like, civics, training, orders, and growth. All, like, great things they definitely want more of. And then their other unique ability is any of their units can build forts. Forts were an essential part of warfare on the Nile, both holding them and assaulting them. So the kind of battle line between Egypt and Kush was often fought over these forts. And also when Kush did control Egypt in the 25th dynasty, they also built quite a lot of forts to defend against Assyria who invaded. So in gameplay terms, this means any unit can build a fort, which gives them quite good flexibility in that they can very quickly lock down an area of the map and defend it. But it also allows them to, like, to push outside of their territory and then, like, lock down that area. And this works really well with their unique units as well, who are very good archers. So they've got the Medjay archers, who have a special ability Volley, which means they get additional attack if adjacent to the same unit. So even just a couple of them together, they suddenly become, very lethal from range, which especially, if you combine with the forts, can really, like, hold an area. And then the Beja archers, who are an upgraded version, who also have Pierce. So this is the ability seen in things like Spearmen, where you can attack through a unit, which has an interesting payoff in that it only works when you're in, like, close range. So it means if you do kind of get your archers a bit closer, then you get more damage, but up to you whether that's worth it or not. And then in terms of other unique things, Kush also have a unique building. So it's the first faction to have this, in addition to their shrines, that is. So one of the most recognisable features of Kush and things they're most known for is the Kushite pyramids. Nobles and rulers of Kush would build pyramids in the style of the Egyptian ones, but these are much smaller, but kind of built in groups. And there's hundreds of them, especially in the, like, kind of religious and cultural capitals. We kind of felt like we had to get these in there. So they are a really interesting building. So they're, upon completing a Kushite pyramid, you get legitimacy. So it's actually the first thing where you build or get legitimacy from building an improvement. And then they also get civics for adjacent shrines, which, combined with the fact that shrines can't go next to each other, means they require an interesting element of city planning to make the most of these. And then the Kushite pyramids also spread Kushite paganism. So with the focus on shrines, I think the, you know, the most common approach is probably going to be have them have Kushite paganism as your state religion, and to probably go with polytheism as the law, because that lets you build as many shrines as you want. But Kushite pyramids also spread Kushite paganism, which is the only way of doing that beyond building shrines. So that means if you do have paganism as your state religion but want to go the monotheistic route, you still have a way to spread your pagan religion. Even if you go monotheism, there's still kind of, like, power in the paganism.
So the Kush are a very interesting addition to Old World. There's this thematical aspect I really like. We get to see how it's a civilization related to Egypt through history and cultural exchange, with some similarities, like what you mentioned. They also know the Egyptian god Amun, and they know it. They know the god by a slightly different name and a slightly different interpretation, but the same god. And those famous Egyptian pyramids, that's not only something uniquely Egyptian. The Kush had their own take on pyramids. And with these very thematic approach to how the nation was designed, it's terrific fun to play. This focus on paganism and shrines that you mentioned as the foundation of the nation's design, I have found it to be one of the most consistently satisfying things in old world, to play Kush with this pagan focus and get good city clusters going with shrines around shrines clustered around Kushite pyramids. It's very fun, and it's especially noteworthy how it doesn't really add new mechanics in itself, but it is an excellent combination of some previously existing mechanics in Old World and choices that have been maybe less common. So you can have a pagan state religion in Old World if you adopt the right law, but that is not something that people usually do, and it's maybe not the best choice most of the time. But with the Kush, you really have the best opportunity to make use of that. And this playstyle of polytheism for unlimited shrines plus divine rule for pagan state religion, it's something you can do in theory with any nation, but it's much, much more fun with Kush than with anyone else. So I think that's something a lot of players will enjoy. Both our new players and returning players should enjoy the unique aspects of Kush. And then, while it's not completely unique, the Kush marks a return of another feature of Old World, which is dynasties. So far, we have had dynasties for Greece, for those who own Heroes of the Aegean DLC. And as a reminder, dynasties, they are minor variations within the same nation, where the nation is the same, but the starting leader and family tree is different. And then with a different dynasty, the nation keeps its nation bonuses, but might have a different bonus attached to the leader. So would you walk us through the Kush leaders, who the default one is and who the additional dynasties are?
Yeah, absolutely. So the default leader is Queen Amanirinas. She's most known for fighting against the Roman Empire. So a bit of background is Rome attacked Kush and sacked the city of Napata, the religious centre I talked about before. And yeah, kind of in retaliation, she led Kush and invaded and looted a load of the cities in Egypt. Kyle stole statues, so there's this quite famous statue head of Augustus was discovered because she looted it, and the head was buried under the steps of one of the Kush temples, with the idea that then everyone's like walking over Augustus's head. Yeah, so I don't know, I just love that.
Yeah, the ancients, they really understood how to humiliate people, right?
Absolutely. And it obviously worked, because Augustus made peace with the Kush, and yeah, they retained their independence, so that's the way to defend against the Roman Empire. So she's a swift hero, is her abilities, so yeah, kind of like very military offensive leader. Then the other dynasties, we've got Queen Amanitore. So she was another of the... both Amanitore and Amanirinas were leaders in the kind of last phase of Kush, which is when their capital moved to the city of Meroe. And this is kind of like known as when they had kind of their most developed, most unique culture. So they had their own Meroitic language, which again, sadly, one of the reasons we don't know that much about them as a nation is that it still remains untranslated today. But one of the things about Meroe is they had all these like independent female rulers. Hikarv wielded loads of power. Yeah, so Amanarinas is one of these, Amanatori is another, and she's quite a different approach in that she's a diligent builder, so very focused on construction. And her unique ability is the diligent trait, and this means that she gets, she starts with a free worker, always good, but then she also gets orders every time an improvement's finished. So this is really cool because it means that even if you're at war, or especially in the early stages, like attacking tribes or, you know, kind of doing something, there's always time to be starting new improvements, to be building. So she can, yeah, really quickly develop cities. And then another is Queen Shnaticut, and she's the first known independent female ruler of Kush. So with her, Kav wanted to represent Meroitic Kush having this kind of golden age of culture and trade. So she's a diplomatic scholar, and on meeting other nations, she gets a free caravan, and then also starts with the literature resource. So yeah, kind of very diplomatic, has a lot of interaction with other nations. And then the other two are from a bit earlier. King Alana was the founder of the Napatan dynasty, kind of talked about earlier. So he's a revered commander, which means his unique revered trait means that new cities start with additional culture. And then also the Kushite pyramids get give culture as well. So he's very culture focused, and this Kav, he was a like almost semi-mythical figure throughout the Napatan dynasty, Kav seen as this, yeah, like very revered founder. And then King Pie is the final one, potentially one of the best known of the leaders of Kush. And this is because he was Alana's grandson, and he was also the founder of the 25th dynasty of Egypt. Basically, he invaded Egypt. His father had already invaded Upper Egypt, and then Pie Kav completed that and founded this dynasty who ruled Egypt until the Assyrian invasion. So he's his special ability is, because apparently he kind of thought of it as this like holy war for Amun, being like, you know, these lands are kind of like granted for us. So he starts with the Shrine of Amani, which also means that they automatically have the pagan religion unlocked. But then also every time he spreads the pagan religion by building a new shrine or Kushite pyramid, the city gains a militia. So it's this really fun kind of like getting more military capability as you're spreading your religion to kind of represent that holy war.
That's again some very interesting parallels between the Kush and Egypt. So how we have King Pie, who is the Kushite king, but he's also the founder of an Egyptian dynasty. And then to contrast the whole thing with female rulers, how for the Kush it was quite normal. There were many ruling queens, while Egypt had, I think, just two pharaohs who were in their own right as full pharaohs. So a lot of interaction, a lot of parallels, but also some very significant differences between these two nations, which really has made it interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully they feel really different and, yeah, different to play.
And I'll just correct one thing. There was a lot more than two female pharaohs. Like, just in the New Kingdom period that the campaign follows, you've got Hatshepsut, you've also got Tuzret, there's two just there, but there are also many others throughout the whole of Egyptian history. Like Nefertiti changed her name and became Neferuaten as a pharaoh.
But the most important thing is that Cleopatra doesn't count.
No, because she's Greek. So that takes us through both parts of the new DLC, Pharaohs of the Nile. The six-part campaign of Egypt and the new faction, the Kush. So Josh, do you have any final comments on the Kush and, you know, what you expect players to enjoy most about the new faction?
I think, like Silver said earlier, it's hopefully people enjoy the focus on parts of the game that aren't necessarily explored that much. So they should be like very different faction to play, and be like really refreshing to come to and try.
Yes, and I have to put another vote in for it's a really fun faction to play with their new unique abilities within Old World. And the campaign, I'm hoping that players will get a lot of fun out of the extreme variability between each scenario. Each one has a different focus within Old World, and there's a couple of unique scenarios that I hope the players find quite fun and challenging.
Yeah, definitely. There's so much variation in the different scenarios, and it's like a really different way of playing Old World, and I enjoyed them so much.
Yeah, it's a great campaign. It's full of historical flavor, and it's also full of ideas that we otherwise don't explore with an Old World, like a whole very zoomed in tactical battle, and some other gameplay ideas. So it provides an excellent change from what we usually see. Very, very much worth playing. And with that, Pharaohs of the Nile with both parts will be available as usual on Steam, on Epic, and on GOG. And as for when it's available, Dale?
Pharaohs of the Nile will be available the first week of October. Go to your favourite store now and wishlist it so that you'll be notified when it becomes available. So that concludes this Mohawk podcast about the new DLC, Pharaohs of the Nile. Thank you for listening, and we hope that you pick up the new DLC and enjoy it. And please join us on our Discord to discuss Pharaohs of the Nile or anything else about Old World. Thank you, Solver. Thank you, Josh, for joining me.
Thanks for having us here, and to all players, we very much look forward to hearing your thoughts on the new DLC.
Absolutely. Hehehehe